everybody? Can you hear us all right? Hello? Hello. Just before we get started, you will see there is a... He's warned me if I describe him as anything. A leggy brunette at the back.
Brunette?
Handing out little tickets for you because the... Oh, right. We need some bits of paper then.
Got a you copy of your book to tear pages
yes,
out.
We were going to see if anybody could spot whether our esteemed panellists here, how good they were at telling the truth, because the title of this panel is Creating Believable Sleuths, and we thought we'd put the emphasis on the believable bit, because, I mean, come on, be honest, would you buy a second-hand car from any of these people? So I asked them to come up with an introduction for themselves, just a very brief introduction, which included one fact that is a porky. It's a lie. It's blatantly untrue. And if you can spot the untruth and you would jot it down on your little bit of paper, then I have bags of books and goodies for you, and we will pick the correct answers out of a hat. So if you would jot them down once our panellists have done their introductions and hand them back to my assistant. Right, Paul, I'm going to ask you to, if you would kick proceedings off. Paul Johnston, sitting at the end there, if you would do your introduction.
I will start by lying. Unfortunately, I've been given a bit of paper by Zoe, which is written in the third person, and not being Julius Caesar. Can you hear me at the back, by the way? Thank you. I find that rather hard to read, so I'm going to read my own handwriting, which is very, very appalling, and therefore if I trip myself up, you'll know why. So, as it says here, I'm Paul Johnston. My 12th novel, The Nameless Dead, has just been published. I've been fortunate enough to win a literary and literally lethal dagger and an engraved piece of plastic for my fiction. I spend most of my time in Greece. I was at school with the former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. I lived on a small island for 6 years, and I've chaired over 300 authors at book festivals, and I'm scared of Zoe Sharp.
Right, and next to Paul is Christopher Wakeling. Chris, if you would read
sure,
your intro.
Paul has chaired 300 of these. This is my first one. I'm really excited to be here. It's great.
We
to
did
see
tell
all.
Him about the initiation rites, which I'm sure you'll all join us with later, but we don't want to scare him too much.
Mine's very brief. Christopher Wakeling worked as a litigation lawyer before turning to writing full-time 10 years ago. He can fly a plane, surf small waves standing up, and walk on his own hands. The Devil's Mask is his fifth novel.
Thank you. And next to Chris is Elsie Tyler. Len, if you would read your introduction.
We did sort of discuss about whether we were actually going to read out our own or whether we'd read out other people's, because I know which bit of this is false, and I'm fairly sure my face is going to give it away when we actually get there. So watch my face carefully, and you could actually be a quarter of the way towards winning the prize. Okay, it says Elsie Tyler intro. Elsie Tyler is the author of four Ethelred and Elsie Herring mysteries, the latest of which is Herring on the Nile. He is now a full-time writer, but has done all sorts of other things in the past. Growing up in Southend, he's had holiday jobs selling ice cream, working at Southend Airport, and clearing mines from the beach. What? More recently, he has been employed as a systems analyst, a cultural attaché, and chief executive of a medical royal college. He is an honorary paediatrician.
Well, for that last bit, I can't say I approve, but I admire your honesty. Anne Zerudi is our last, but certainly not least, of our panel members. Anne.
Well, follow that. We've all had some interesting jobs in the past, haven't we? I'll read mine. I'll try and read mine in the first person, actually. I'll translate it, if I may. I was led into writing my series of novels featuring Hermes Deactorus, the Greek detective, after abandoning a lucrative career, which included a spell working on Wall Street, to become a fisherman's wife on a tiny island in southern Greece. Like many authors, especially men, I've held down some interesting jobs to fund the writing habit, including including donning a butcher's apron to sell pork pies and sausages, playing a begowned extra in a BBC production of Jane Eyre, and picking mutant jelly babies from a conveyor belt in a sweet factory.
Right, so if you would like to hazard a guess as to what you think the untruths are there, we shall be handing out some prizes at the end of the panel. So if we move on to our topic, which, as I say, is creating believable sleuths. Paul, the thrillers concentrate on trust and betrayal of trust, but you've taken this to a new level with your main protagonist, who is the crime writer Matt Wells in The Nameless Dead, because he's been brainwashed to become an assassin who is triggered by a single word. How did you decide on this very extreme form of internal conflict for your character?
Well, the fact that my main character, as you say, is a crime writer, it clearly has absolutely nothing to do with me. I decided I was going to put him through the ringer as much as I possibly could. Some kind of strange wish fulfillment scenario going on there. And so he goes from being chased by a serial killer to getting involved with Satanists, to getting involved with Nazis, to getting brainwashed, as you say. And actually, being slightly more serious, this did strike me as being quite an interesting sort of existentialist situation to be in, where you have no idea what you might possibly do even in the next half hour, just when a little button is in effect pressed in your head. So this kind of lack of, you know, protagonists of crime novels and thrillers tend to often be very self-assured, very powerful, very outgoing. My guy is much more of a sort of doubting Thomas about himself, a skeptic, if you like. And I think that's sort of where that all came out of. It's all in the philosophy, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
David Hume. Could out-consume.
So, do heroes need to be heroic, or do you prefer your heroes some fatal flaws? Len, what about you? Do you?
Oh, I think the realism of your character is in the flaws. People who understand gemstones say, for example, that the beauty of an emerald, depends on the flaws on the flaws in it. That said, I think sometimes these days we do try to make our narrators a little too flawed. All of our narrators have to be sort of on drugs or alcoholics or loners. I see a lot of people in the audience nodding, which either means you agree with me or you are in some way with them on this whole drink, drugs issue.
No, they thought you were offering drugs.
Oh, right. That's part of the initiation ceremony that we'll do in a moment. So no, I'm very much into the flawed hero, flawed narrator.
Yes. Anybody else want to pick up on that?
Yes, I have quite an interesting problem with that, because those of you who've read my books will know that my hero is by no means a typical crime detective. There's certain metaphysical and mythological aspects in my book, which means that Hermes really is quite difficult to make him a flawed character. But I would say in general, fatal flaws I think is a bit strong. Perhaps that's what Len is talking about. But I think the flaws in a character, if you take the absolute classic of Sherlock Holmes, of course, his flaws were what made him truly interesting. You know, his intelligence counterbalanced with his drug habit, interesting enough. You see, it goes back a long time, doesn't it? But I think flaws...
It doesn't take long for our minds to descend
to that level. I think flaws are essential in any believable character, because who, after all, is perfect? I tend to agree with Len, actually, that perhaps these days it's becoming almost a cliché that a hero in a detective novel has to be hard-drinking. Divorced, that seems to be another
thing,
doesn't it? They've got to be divorced. Unable to form relationships, etc., etc. But obviously, that's what makes them interesting, and that's why people buy the books because of the flaws. Essentially, they all have a good side to them, which redeems them, and I think that's crucial too.
Chris, I thought your hero in your latest book, The Devil's Mask, was very interesting, apart from the fact he seems addicted to coffee rather than any other form of drug. Does he ever manage to get a haircut? Because he's constantly through the book trying to go off and get a haircut. But how do you see his flaws?
Well, I quite like relatively mundane flaws. So, he's obviously needing a haircut isn't a terrible flaw.
The book set in 1810, the pace of life was slower then.
350 pages looking for a barber.
I thought they didn't have any hair in 1810. I thought they shaved their heads and wore wigs.
Damn.
Gotcha.
He's quite frustrated and bored, and he acts out of those relatively sort of humdrum motivations, and those things power the book. I mean, I think that a character's flaw is only really interesting if it adds into the story one way or another. And just having alcoholics sitting in bars and then going off to solve crimes, and the two things aren't particularly related, doesn't interest me. But a more humdrum, straightforward flaw that feeds into the narrative, I'm in favour of. I enjoy.
Well, I think another thing about flaws is they needn't be in the character themselves. They can be kind of contextual to the character. I mean, I had a detective called Alex Mavros, a half Greek, half Scottish guy, who's not exactly flaw, but what kept him driving through life was the fact that he'd lost his brother sort of 25 years before, and his whole life as a missing persons specialist, you know, is inspired by this. So I think that it can be outside as well as, you know, it can be external as well as internal.
It's an interesting thought to what extent we're putting our own flaws into our characters.
We'll come to that. And your investigator is very lightly described in the books, predominantly as a fat man in white tennis shoes. He's not the usual sleuth hero of a crime novel, but he does seem to fit perfectly with your Greek island setting.
Mm.
So how much did the setting mould the character and the setting and vice versa?
I think Hermes really is, again, as I said before, he's a little bit different perhaps to other people's detectives. He's more a figure of justice. Which I think appeals to people a lot, because wouldn't it be lovely if there were in real life some man who would appear when things were going horribly wrong and just come and sort everything out, leave everything straight and then disappear, which is essentially what Hermes does. So he grew out of the Greek landscape and my interest in Greek mythology, also in Jungian psychology. But he's very much set in the landscape. His origins, actually, the model for him was a Greek bank manager who was on a tiny island where nobody is a snappy dresser, as Paul, I'm sure, will confirm.
No, I was.
This guy was a very
snappy owning that
dresser.
Moustache, you have no room to talk.
I didn't have it.
He's named it. It's called Monty, the moustache.
But this guy was a snappy dresser, and he provided the physical description for Hermes. I saw this guy up at a cemetery, actually. He was wandering around a cemetery, which was kind of a strange thing for a bank manager to do, but there's not much to do in the Greek islands in winter, so a visit to the cemetery is just something that you do. So in that way, he very much grew out of the landscape, but his roots are in mythology and in all things Greek. So.
Because, Chris, your book is not only set in a different time from the contemporary period, 1810, it's 5 years after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, it's 3 years after the abolition of slavery in England, and it's actually set here in Bristol. What difficulties did you have in creating a character that rings true in a time period so far removed from contemporary life?
Lots.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah. It's the first novel I've written that is a historical novel. I wrote another novel that has a bit set in World War II, which I seem to know more about by osmosis. And I wrote this book because I moved here just as the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade was in the papers. I moved from London, which trafficked more slaves, but obviously it meant more to Bristol. And the whole process of writing the book for me was doing loads of research in quite an organic way, writing a very long book and then cutting all the research out so that it didn't read really clunkily. And certainly with the central character, Inigo Bright, he started out wandering down the streets, thinking about who was on the throne and the Napoleonic Wars and the abolition of the slave trade and all these macro things. And then gradually most of that got trimmed out, because I don't think we walk down the street thinking about those things the whole time. We are more concerned about things that affect us on a personal level. So some of that still remains, obviously, to give the book its location. But I looked for the universal things in the character.
Mm. And Len, your book is quite unusual, I think, in that you have your two main protagonists, Ethelred and Elsie, in your Herring series of books, and you write them both from first-person viewpoints. Mm. So you're getting inside the heads of two characters who often have a very different idea of what's going on, as I found. And they're also, one's a literary agent and one's a crime writer.
Mm.
this sounds like a minefield of you know, trying to pick your way through. But how did you come to this narrative style of having the two first-person protagonists?
Yeah. I mean, I think I did it because I rather enjoyed it in other people's books. It was nice having a change of pace from one chapter to another. It was nice being able to use different typefaces as well. I was able to use three different typefaces in the first book. And so, as you say, what I really enjoy about it is being able to give two completely conflicting accounts of the same incident. So Ethelred will meet somebody and describe her as a gracious hostess in a midnight blue gown. Elsie will see the same person and describe her as a slapper in a blue frock, who clearly never heard of the phrase mutton dressed as lamb. So you get the two of them sort of constantly playing off against each other. So it's fun. It's fun to write it.
So how do you go about constructing a character? Do you create this complex biography beforehand? Do you write reams of background, or do you just fly by the seat of your pants?
I've got two ways of doing it. The first one is
Chris, you don't have to put your hand up.
Pulling rank. It's an organic process, honestly, kind of adding to the characters as I write the book. But I teach creative writing as well, and I wheel out this incredibly intimidating 150 questionnaire for writers to hone their central characters by answering these questions. And I've never done that myself. But
don't do as I do, do as I say.
It normally takes them 40 minutes so I can read a book or something. I have, whilst they've been doing it, sort of got bored and started to do it on my own central characters. So this is completely reverse engineering them, and realised, Christ, I don't know anything about that aspect of them, and have filled in gaps that way. But generally, it's a more organic process for me.
I have seen that those grids that you're talking about, you can download them off the internet, you know, and develop your characters that way. I just think that would kill any character stone dead. That is my personal view. Mine tend to evolve, often from a glimpse of something that I've seen, a glimpse of a person, a snatch of a conversation. They're an idea when you start out. Obviously, is that you, Len?
I think that's me. I think I'm unbelievable.
What was I saying?
Before you were so rudely interrupted.
They evolve organically
is probably the word. Although
yes.
I think when you're creating a character, obviously you have a role for that character. So certain aspects are preordained. If you're looking for an arch baddie, it's no use to having a woman who bakes cupcakes, is it really? It's got to be someone.
Oh, actually, you could make that really sinister.
You could do something with
that. They don't have to have a white fluffy cat.
Yeah.
You could having them baking cupcakes as they're discussing killing off the goodies could be quite interesting.
Yeah. But I think once you've created a character, I do find it essential to make notes of what I've written about them. What colour hair they've got, what their name is actually, because it's quite easy to forget. You find three chapters down the line, you've actually changed their name. So I do write down basic details about them, but I think, you know, the grid system, I think, really would be death to any kind
no,
of.
No, I agree with you. It's quite a good way of kickstarting things for people who haven't yet made, you know, begun. But I think you internalise a lot of that anyway. You just you gradually come to know who the characters, what their relationship is with their grandparents, one way or another, if it's important, or you don't.
And the other side of this coin is the extent to which the what you've written stimulates the reader to do quite a large amount of character creation. I mean, you know, we're all readers as well, obviously. Everyone's written a reader. And, you know, having a kind of incredibly complex, I'm not referring to a grid here, Chris, but an incredibly complex description about the physical and mental characteristics of this character with no area, no room for deduction or induction, whatever you want to call it, by the reader would be hopeless. I mean, so one has to deliberately leave gaps. And often people don't describe characters physically very much. I mean, there's kind of sways in and out of fashion. But I personally don't tend to describe characters hugely physically. You know, you leave it to the reader and then hopefully the film producer to.
yes, one lives in
or not, as the case may be.
But I find putting an age on a character it helps just locate them slightly, and after that it's up to people to.
Mm.
Of describing, because it's incredibly difficult to do in first person unless your character happens to walk past and look in a lot of mirrors and admire their reflection, which is I hate that. So
yeah, you writing the sort of thing we do, though, particularly when you're writing series, you do have to keep a track of your characters. You can start the character with just some simple characteristic. I mean, the sort of annoying person who doesn't switch off their phone in a absolutely, which sort of defines them. But afterwards, when you get to sort of the third or fourth book, you really have to have recorded the stuff they've done. So Elsie, for example, at some stage put up her rates from 12.5% to 15%, because in the first book she was charging Ethelred 12.5% as his agent, but now she's charging 15. I don't know when she did it.
He probably doesn't either.
No, I was just going to say, does she refer to him as this dreadful person who steals 85% of her income?
Oh, absolutely. She does from time to time say 15% of that book is mine.
Actually, I think we're hitting on a very important part of how characters are constructed by authors. I mean, my crime writer, stroke sleuth, in the first of those novels, The Death List, he's completely driven by revenge because he's been dropped by his publisher and by his agent. He ends up in this horrible situation where the serial killer, starts targeting his publisher and his literary agent, which of course is absolutely tragic.
So characters are constantly driven by need and conflict. What do you do to create that conflict for your characters? Do you put them in physical danger? Do you put their loved ones in physical danger? What do you do? Len, how do you create conflict?
I haven't really read a lot of books on how to write, but the one thing I do remember from a book on how to write novels is no conflict, no story. That the conflict is absolutely central to what we do. And I guess I have a number of conflicts going on. I mean, I have this constant conflict between Ethelred and Elsie, for example, and their attitude to life. But I think at the same time, Ethelred has a conflict with modernity. He just really doesn't like living even in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. And so at one point in the latest book, Herring on the Nile, when a terrorist confiscates his iPhone, he is just so relieved to have got rid of it.
I like the idea of a terrorist confiscating things.
Well, yes. Bad. I will let you have that back at the end of
see me at the end of the lesson. Yes, absolutely. So have you ever painted yourselves into a corner with a character? That either in a series book that's done something that you really wish you hadn't done in a later book. I mean, it's the famous quote is that Ian Rankin wishes he'd made Rebus rather younger in the first book because he pushed him really past retirement age by the time he finished. But have you ever had to kind of slightly ignore things you put in earlier books, or have you gone back in a standalone and scrubbed an aspect of a character that you decided was difficult for you?
I don't think the background's hugely problematical, because, I mean, you know, there will always be some fan who sends you an abusive email saying, you know, you said in the first book that, you know, you had brown hair.
Yeah, so sorry about that, Paul.
But, it was, yeah, I thought it was. That's why I'm scared of you. But the point is that certainly throughout a series, and I guess throughout individual books as well, characters develop. I mean, that's the whole point of interest, really, or at least part of the point of interest for the reader as well as for the writer. So it's much more important to show them, you know, learning from experiences, or possibly refusing to learn from experiences or whatever else. But the effect of the story on the character is really more important than what one may have got wrong in the past. Not that I've ever made any such mistakes myself.
Oh, of course not. No.
Because I always use little cards and fill them in and no.
I think one of the issues with writing series crime is avoiding yourself getting bored with those little things that you put in to be the touchstones of your character.
Mm.
And
yep.
Again, if an easy referral is you know, to Sherlock Holmes and his violin and his deerstalker hat. My character Hermes smokes a particular brand of cigarettes, and you end up almost doing a cut and paste into each new book. You think, here, okay, it's time for the cigarettes to come out now. Now I'm thinking, gee, wouldn't it be great if he could change his brand of cigarettes? Perhaps, you know, perhaps he'd like to smoke Marlboros for a change.
Has he thought
or
of
something.
Nicotine patches?
Well, perhaps so. Perhaps he should give up smoking. But yet, I think there's a feel amongst readers that those details can be very comforting. You know, that they hook you in. It's familiar. People grow familiar with the character and actually like those touches. So you stick with them, and it's not that they're mistakes. It's just that you just think, well, have I tied myself in too tightly to that now? And really, it would be nice if he could do something different, but it would be too out of character. So that, I think, particularly with series crime writing, that can be quite frustrating for the writer, perhaps more than the reader.
Because Chris, you've tended to write standalones, haven't you? So you're creating your characters from scratch every time.
Yeah, and I mean, question about writing characters at the beginning of a book who don't have a place by the time you reach the end of the draft certainly still applies. And I think I've gone back and, you know, you look at each scene and think, what's happening here? Who are these people? And why did I put them in it? And you realise, well, I could in fact just put those two together and don't need all of them in there. Or I once wrote a whole book with a dog in it. The dog was the protagonist dog, and the dog was called, I can't even remember, it was a fairly obvious dog name.
Fido?
Something like that. Let's call it Fido. My wife said, that's a rubbish name, call it SpongeBob. And so I went back and thought, that's immediately more arresting and somehow comic, and now the dog has to have a personality. Where did the dog come from? How did he get that name? And suddenly a character which was became very important to the novel simply by changing his name.
So how do you choose names for your characters? Do you random name generators, or how do you people who've wronged you in the past, or
random,
you know,
name generators? What's that? Is that a software program?
Yeah, it's
really?
A website with random name generators, and you can pick a level of obscurity.
But who wants to write a book with a randomly generated name? I mean, the whole point of being an author is to invent the name yourself. Right.
Well, it prevents libel, perhaps, but.
No one's ever noticed this, but the names of the characters in my book. So the first book I wrote, the protagonist was called Lewis Penn. I think Loosen Penn, Lucia Penn, I'll write a book. And then there was another guy who was very, very...
No, Chris, please leave.
this character in a book who was it's a cheerful book, opens with him about to hang himself. And Harry Brinkman. And no one's ever spotted this or mentioned.
You reckon?
I do think this is one of the problems, though. When you have fun with names, nobody reading actually notices. So in Persistent Illusion, for example, almost all of the surnames were surnames of philosophers. Nobody ever noticed that. It's fun. It's great fun. In Herring on the Nile, I decided I was going to give almost all the characters names of detectives. So there's one in there called Raffles, and there's one in there called Purbright. That's a slightly more obscure one.
Raffles was a thief. Characters from
Watson. Watson was another one. So I mean, it's not necessarily. But they were names from crime, from crime books. But then, of course, what happens is, and I know Zoe, you've done this. You can auction off names for charity. So right in the middle of all these names that you have organised, you get this totally random name of somebody who just happens to have put in the highest bid for that particular character, and then you somehow have to work that into your into your scheme.
You get paid for that. That's
you don't get a charity.
your initiation ritual is going to be very hard.
As a missing trick.
Chris will, of course, sell off character names.
Well, and the sums are not large even then. Not in my case.
It can be quite embarrassing, though, because in one of my books, a lady called Frances Neagley bid to be a character, and she'd previously bid to be in Lee Child's, in fact, she was in two of Lee Child's books, and I've been accused by people of stealing Lee's characters. Or, you know, did he lend me a character because I'd run out? And you know, but I mean, we do have an author here who did call one of his characters Quintilian Dalrymple, which is possibly the most memorable.
Well, actually, there was philosophy in there as well. It's interesting what you said, Len, because I was being a serious smartass. This is about 15 years ago, and I've stopped being like one of those now, of course, as you can imagine. And I thought it'd be really cool in this sort of philosophical, this was in futuristic Edinburgh, and there was a lot of Platonic stuff and whatever else, and some death. And I thought it'd be really interesting to have a character protagonist whose initials were QED. So I got Quintilian easily because my old tutor at college was an expert on Quintilian, and that was a little bit of a kind of nod towards him. Not that he was impressed. then I wanted a Scottish name, and Dalrymple was a kind of weirdy kind of Scottish name. And then I was left with an E, and I was having this conversation in a pub with a pal, and we were trying to work out what E would be, and the best we came up with was Eric. Quintilian Eric Dalrymple. Oddly enough, I'm sorry if anyone in the audience is called Eric, but the Eric actually never featured. We just let that go.
It was a silent Eric.
Yes, he ended up being QD rather than QED. But I was going to say about the randomly generated names. I mean, the Mavros character, as Anne would know, Mavros means black in Greek, so that was a play on noir in my Greek series. But in my most recent series, the guy, the crime writer detective, is called Matt Wells, which I thought was like completely dull, boring, deliberately sort of not a problematical name. And about a week after the first book was published, I got an email from a journalist on The Guardian whose name is Matt Wells.
Oops.
It's okay, nothing serious happened, but I think he was just putting down a pointer that someone in the literary desk had said, "Hey, look, you're in this, mate." And you seem to be killing someone.
Yes, how often do people accuse you of using either part of their characteristics in a book or that part of their names in a book, and are they ever correct to do so? Are you, getting rid of some of your venom in print?
I think people do like to think that they've spotted people that they know you know in your books, but I have to say I very rarely use an entire character in a book, simply because it's very hard to find someone who fits the plot. you might borrow a physical description, and I think that's a slightly different matter. Sometimes you see, again with Hermes, you see someone who is so striking that they're really an absolute gift of a character, of a physical description of a character, and I think that's fair dues. I don't know what everybody else thinks about that. But to be blunt, I don't know whether I know anyone interesting enough to put in one of my books. Does that sound dastardly and all? Apart from that, he hasn't currently accepted, obviously. But I think when you're writing a character, you're stressing their characteristics. Most people are very, very complex people, and characters in fiction, in 70,000-80,000 words, you're restricted to what you can say about a person. So I would just like to say that I have never used a person, so anyone who thinks that I have needs to reconsider.
And there, Your Honour, rest the case on defence. Yes.
I killed my ex-wife.
and what about in the books?
I said in a novel.
Oh.
Admittedly, swallowing the words.
Yes.
Right. I did this geyser, of course. But there's a bit more facial hair involved in this kind of stuff. on her part, not mine. oddly enough, I never heard anything back from her, ever, on any subject whatsoever. Other than that, I don't think one would do it, because, I mean, actually, I have heard of people, not necessarily in the crime genre, but I have heard of people, obviously, I think we probably all have heard of novelists who've been caught out by people, you know, by being sued for libel or whatever. So one probably is a little bit careful.
Yeah. I think I've only ever been tempted to do it once. A lady novelist, that's the only description I'm going to give you of her, a lady novelist once annoyed me greatly. And so in the book I was writing then, I put in what I consider to be a hideous caricature of her, made her really absolutely evil. But then during the 9 months I was writing the book, I actually got to like her rather better. The character also became nicer and nicer and nicer until it was absolutely unrecognisable. But what I do think is...
How very disappointing.
If you put in a caricature of somebody which is sufficiently accurately nasty, they never recognise themselves anyway. So you're quite safe.
And the opposite... the opposite is true as well, where you write a character completely thinking you've made it up, and somebody reads it and sees themselves. My wife's always saying, that's me. She knows it's not her, and I never intended it to be her, but she fears it. Or, you know, subconsciously you've kind of put something in there, but never intentionally. No.
Oh, I've run out of people who annoyed me enough to kill or mutilate them in books now, so I take requests. So if anybody has anyone who's really pissed them off, then just let me know, and I'll do nasty things to them in print for you. So, speaking of doing nasty things to people in print, what skills do your protagonists have that you possess yourselves? Is there anything, how much of you is in your characters?
I think inevitably there's a lot of the writer in your characters. My son thinks that I am Hermes de Actoris to a T. In very many ways, he has a certain way with words, a certain cutting way, which there's an incident in one of the books in a post office queue where someone jumps in front of him in the queue and gets their comeuppance, and my son swears that that is exactly the kind of thing that I would do. So I think inevitably there's a lot of the writer, certainly in major characters, whether you think there is or not, and often it takes someone from the outside to look at that character and say, oh gosh, that's just you. And it's not always flattering, you know, so you sometimes it's so subconscious that you don't know you've given yourself away, actually, in very many ways. But I think if you're writing soulfully and from the heart, it's inevitable that that's going to happen.
Because both Paul and Len, you both have characters who are crime writers. I mean, this
well,
is not
like
very
me.
Disguising it very heavily.
Well, that was I don't know about Len's situation, but I mean, I was definitely sending myself up as well as sending my ex-publisher, my ex-agent up. and it kind of rather worryingly developed from there. And it, four books on, we've got the guy's lost his memory. That was actually a deliberate attempt to sort of reinvent myself. To imagine what would it be like if you suffered complete amnesia. I mean, I know it's Jason Bourne and all the rest of it, but I do kind of riff in other directions too. If you had to start from scratch and try and work out who you were, how would you do that? Actually, going back to what we've been talking about, really, about how you create characters, this was almost like recreating a character in the third book in the series, you know. I suppose we all give ourselves little challenges, otherwise the books end up being dead boring.
Somebody interviewed... Oh, sorry, we were about to move on to something.
No, I was just going to say, if you have filled in your little bits of paper, would you hand them sort of to the middle of the rows and Andy will come. No, I won't describe him as anything else.
So
Andy will come and
do the question about what we hate, the characteristics or characters that we hate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes, put your name on the bit of paper as well. Otherwise, we'll have to recognise your handwriting.
No pseudonyms.
No pseudonyms.
We got to get all four right.
If nobody gets all four right, then three.
You go down to one, basically.
There's going to be some statistics around.
Does Andy know the answers?
Yes. I have given him the answers. And Andy will be sorting out all the correct ones.
Just say it was random. One in 16.
Oh, stop doing mathematics, then.
Not because of four, surely. It'd be much worse than that.
So we should have...
So it's time to dish the dirt, I think. What characteristics do you read in other people's work about characters that you really dislike? What annoys you when you... What makes you throw a book across the room when you read a character doing certain things?
You now watch four authors commit suicide because we're about to insult your favourite characters and whatever else. And I'm going first.
Yes, you are.
It's Anza, really. No. I absolutely cannot bear Lord Peter Wimsey and the snobbery and the class. Well, yeah, I told you you weren't going to like it.
I love Peter Wimsey.
Is it too late to leave?
Doesn't matter now. It's nearly finished. And the next one.
American Psycho. I mean, I found that's the only book that I've been reading on the train and actually wanted to sort of tilt down because it was. See what I was reading. It was so vicious. But I was obviously an amazing piece of work. But I did find myself bridling when Bateman walk into a room and spot the other side exactly what the person was wearing. Not only what they were wearing, but the labels, the thickness of their business cards. Clearly it's done for literary effect. But
satire, I think, is the term.
One of the effects. It annoyed me slightly after a while.
The chopping the women apart with axes.
Fine.
A bit dumb.
Oh no, he was.
It's the business cards.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I tempted just to say Dan Brown, but. One of the things that annoyed me most about a characteristic was I read a book once which had a 5-year-old who thought and spoke and acted exactly as if they were grown up. Now, I think having a child narrator is actually quite good. It's something like The Go-Between, where they see everything but don't understand what's going on. But this was a child who saw everything and understood precisely what was going on. And that spoiled the entire book for me. But in terms of the classics, well, yes, I mean, a spinster living in St. Mary Mead, who stumbled over the
suicide on stage.
Okay.
What is the world coming to?
It's more of a characteristic for me, and what I always find implausible is those policemen who are grateful for some member of the public having helped them solve the case. Are there any policemen in the room? No, then I can safely say every policeman I've ever met, and I have met a fair number for various different reasons, they're arrogant and secretive. And go to great lengths to keep the general public as far away from their crime scenes as they possibly can. So the thought of anyone from Lestrade in Sherlock Holmes forwards in crime writing history thanking a member of the public or welcoming them into their investigation, I find completely implausible. But I do still like Sherlock Holmes.
And Zoe, your answer? You're not expecting? You're not escaping?
Oh, I'm sort of...
Participating in moderator is the term. Come on.
What do I really dislike? I just dislike characters who get things wrong all the time. And I'm afraid that's one of my pet hates. And we'd be here all afternoon if I was going to give you examples. So
one example would suffice.
Well, seeing as we've already made ourselves unpopular, Dan Brown. I have to say, not for the usual reasons, but because at one point he escapes by Range Rover across a field, and he's clearly never even been near a Range Rover, never mind been inside one or driven, because he just a ridiculous number of mistakes, just silly things like that. So that's my little rant over. I feel much better now. I'm calm. Right, on that note, I will throw it open to questions. Does anybody have any questions for our lovely panelists here? Yes, the lady there.
Are there any black holes that you don't want to go into? Characters or characteristics that might be too close to somebody in a family where you just don't want to intrude?
For anybody who didn't hear the question, are there any black holes in characteristics, anything that would be too close to home that you don't want to touch on?
Child abuse and pederasty and so on is a step too far for me. I've got small kids, so couldn't do that. Bit of a downer, but anyway.
Yeah. I think there is this danger, though, of drawing too much. Well, we all draw on our own experiences, obviously, and in some way intruding onto your family. things they've said to you, things that have, you know, have happened within the family. And I think that I mean, you said, Chris, I think that your wife had said something like, "Did I really say that?" or whatever.
Is that me?
Is that
yes.
me? Elsie will say things to Ethelred, and my wife will say, "Did I say that to you?"
No, the flip side of that is, I mean, I don't think anything's off limits at all, and I would, when she says that, I say, "So what?" But there's matters of taste, or not wanting simply to butcher a woman for no apparent reason in a book. I mean, I wouldn't want to go and do that. But as regards the people around me and the things that I see day to day, I it's all up for grabs.
I think it's difficult, actually. You know, as a writer, writing for your public and knowing that your mother is going to read what you've written. Because my mother actually gave a copy of my first book to the next door neighbours, but she literally got a black marker pen and took out all the swear words and the sex scene and just marked it out because that was just too embarrassing. So you just have to sort of rise above that and think.
You can't. Can't double guess your mum though.
In my
first book, there's a. I wrote it looking at a beach. Very nice to do that. And there was loads of inappropriate wave imagery in it, and I cut most of it out, but I left a little bit in. And my mum, kind of, gave me the nod one day and said, "I thought you handled the sex scenes really sensitively," and there was precious little in there. And she had construed the waves on the beach as that, and it was completely.
The secret lives. Of people's parents, yes, I am.
I'm including Ewing's question, Zoe. Is there anything in any of your characters that you'd like to change in hindsight?
No, I don't think so. Otherwise, I would have gone back and edited. But
I kind of wish that my protagonist had been a bit more like Jack Reacher. It's easily done.
No, not really. Not on a character level. I mean, every time you open the book and look to read from it, there's bits that I would change, but not necessarily characters wholesale. No.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think there's always I try to avoid reading my previous books because I think there's always something I think, oh, could have done that better. But I think that's just the job. At some point, you have to cut it off, don't you? Say, right, this is the finished product, and this is what we're going with. But characters, no, I would say.
Characteristics. I think I would have made Elsie swear a little bit less.
Mother problems.
Well, absolutely. No, if I was giving a reading in a library in the West Midlands, and the librarian said, "Would I please censor what I was going to read?" Because there were children present in the audience, and I read through it. They didn't seem anything too terrible in what she
until
was saying.
Until you started reading.
Until I started reading, then I started censoring myself. And it's also what you say about mothers and so on. I mean, when I go and visit my in-laws in Wales, for example, my wife won't let some of them read my books.
Right, I think we've time for one last question.
Yeah.
Yes, the lady at the back now.
Do you find sometimes that your characters start veering off in a particular direction, and how much do you let them go in the direction, or how much do you have to bring them back because you need them to do certain things that you can't?
Right, how much free rein do you give your characters, or are they allowed to veer off in direction?
I think you have to give them free rein, because the way I write my book, I don't plan my books. The books, you know, I start chapter one, word one, and work through from there. And I think if you get out of your own way and your character's way, they will lead the novel where it should be going. You have to trust the subconscious process and just let it grow in that way. So if a character's doing something you think is out of character, my view is always just go with it, because it's probably going to lead to some interesting plot developments.
Yeah, no, I agree absolutely. I think when your characters take over, it's the most wonderful part of the writing experience. It's amazing when you get to the end of the page and you think, I didn't know they were going to do that. I didn't know they were going to say that. But somehow on the page, that's what's happened.
Sorry, but I'd agree with that. Apart from I tend to know where they're going to end up.
I don't let my characters dictate to me what the end of the book is.
Right, okay.
But they dictate to me virtually every other part of the book.
Yeah,
yes.
A little fun in that.
Yes.
I don't let my bloody characters dictated to me at all. I'm the captain of this ship. I do well do what I tell you.
Yes, everything I know I've learnt from the people I keep in my basement.
Yes.
Right, we are nearly out of time, so we have three, only three correct answers. Gosh, you're all obviously such believable liars. Paul Johnson, he said he was at school with ex-Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He was with it at school with ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Ooh.
I didn't know him. I never spoke to him. And he was a very good actor.
Chris Wakeling cannot walk on his hands.
Yeah. Oh. He will do in a minute.
Len Tyler has never sold ice cream. And Anne Zarudi has never been an extra in Jane Eyre. So I've just picked one of these. Chris Ewan. Right, sorry. So we are nearly done. It only remains for me to thank very much my panellists. We will be signing in Merchant 4. If I'm sure you would all love to rush out and buy these people's lovely books. We also have another book bag to give away. So the lady in the purple jumper at the back, yes? Don't look so shocked. You will get a book bag of books.
It's a bomb. It's not a book bag.
And the last thing to remind you is that there is a quiz tonight in the Greenhouse pub just over the road, which starts at, I believe, 7.30. And hopefully the questions won't be so esoteric that nobody knows the answers. Although I have to say, I think last year we called ourselves, our team, the BP Complaints Department, because we knew how bad we would be. So thank you very much indeed for coming, and thank you to my panellists.
Thank you, Zoe.
Paul Johnson, Chris Wakeling, Elsa.